It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
If you want edginess, then the new anthology of short stories called Anatomies may be for you. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. One reviewer described this work by Susan McCarty as a daring debut collection in which she steers lives according to the characters' bodies. Stories range from two characters caught in the aftermath of a zombie apocalypse to a woman who returns to Iowa to binge on food and relationships. And we know for our listeners that these can be some tough subjects to tackle. McCarty teaches creative writing here at Salisbury University and has published essays and stories in the Utney Reader, among other journals. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how did you decide to collect these stories? Obviously, you did not write them all at once. How did this collection come about?
Sure. Well, I've been writing, a lot of these stories are pretty old, and I've been writing them for a while and sort of collecting them as I went without a clear narrative focus or collection focus. But when I was at the University of Utah, I wrote the final story, Anamnesis and Epilogue, and which is an accounting of sort of my fears and my own body. And anamnesis is a medical history. That's how we use it colloquially. But it's also this idea that Plato put forth that all of the knowledge that we have is inside our bodies when we're born. So we have everything we'll ever know is inside us. So I thought those two ideas really dovetailed for me, this idea that that our body is the site. Our bodies are the site and the source of narrative and of story. So I think of Anamnesis as a kind of web page, and I think of many of the stories in this collection as sort of hyperlinks. I sort of start with my body and then write other stories sort of based on some of the experiences I've had and that I recount briefly in Anamnesis.
Now, you've been described as revealing sort of ways we use our body to confront our hidden selves. I mean, is that, do you think that describes what you're doing here?
Yeah, I think that in some sense, because everything happens in our bodies, I mean, we can't live in the world without them, right. That all narrative has a site or a source in our bodies. And I think our hidden selves are those selves that we sort of maybe don't want the world to see, or maybe they're the selves that we don't think of as our best selves. And I was interested in mining those stories or those ideas in a way that sort of breaks them open. So a metaphor I really like is the metaphor of the scar, which is an indication or reminder that you were once pierced by the world in some way. And I think that all these characters in these books have been pierced by the world, either literally or, you know, in some kind of psychological sense. So the scar is sort of the idea of the hidden self. It covers what once happened, but it's a reminder that it's still there.
Now, a lot of your characters obviously show some poor judgment, and obviously they make some bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And yet, people who reviewed your book say that you have some sympathy for these human foibles as a sort of human condition.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the foibles are my own or my friends or my family's. So I feel I have a lot of sympathy in that sense. I take a lot of my story ideas and my story kind of emotional arcs from my own experiences. But I also think that a character without foibles is kind of not a character at all. Everyone makes bad decisions. And one reason I have been a fiction reader all my life and is because I am really interested in seeing how those bad decisions play out in the world in some ways. Characters have to make decisions for things to happen to them. And sometimes the things that happen to them are things that are not the intended outcome of what they wanted. And I'm really interested in that. I mean, I think that's life in a certain sense. So yes, foibled characters, flawed, very flawed characters are characters I'm interested in.
I mean, it's something about Dorothy Parker, who wrote a whole series of short stories, mm-hmm. and in it, it was this very, I mean, sometimes it can be very despairing, I guess, but that she seemed to concentrate on the foibles and the interaction, particularly between human beings, that they kind of interact with their failures or their conflicts, their foibles, mm-hmm. and create this sort of synergy, as it were, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we use the word baggage. We all have baggage, and that those are stories we drag with us our whole lives. So, no one makes a decision, not a character, not a human, without that those past stories and those past experiences informing the decisions that they make. And this is how we get bad decisions or poor judgment. And I think that's really human and really interesting.
There are a number of stories that, I mean, we could talk about any number one of them. One is the indirect object, which describes this uncomfortable encounter between a tutor and the father of one of his students. Set up the story for us, and what was the inspiration for writing this, and what were you trying to say with this?
Sure. The story is, well, it came about because I spent a little bit of time as an ACT tutor in the Midwest. I was finishing grad school, and I needed something to sort of fill the gaps of my grants and loans. Mm-hmm. So I began tutoring, and it very quickly struck me that it was just a kind of, it was tutoring for the ACT, and it was sort of a miserable job. You weren't really allowed to teach the students. You sort of had to stick to this book that they give you. And the students were there because their parents wanted them to be there, so they were really uninterested in doing anything more but the minimum of work that it would take to get them to score a few points higher on the ACT. So I just kind of imagined what a life would look like. I was able to move out of that job, but I was wondering what a character who was kind of stuck in that job and stuck in grad school, what that character would look like, and what decisions he might make, and what his sort of attitude would be over the long term, having a job like that. So the story is about a tutor who is run out of funding in grad school, and he's just sort of floundering, and he's poor, and he is really kind of resentful about his job and resentful of the students, and he's just kind of burnt out. And one of his students dies, and the parents want to meet the tutor, and for various reasons that I won't reveal,
right.
Come to have some interactions with the tutor. And I think one of the things that also struck me when I was tutoring, and one of the issues that this story takes on, and probably the thing that the story is about for me, is the idea that we're living in this age where people don't read, or they read in these little chunks. And I find as a teacher that students are becoming less and less literate of, they're becoming less and less able to sort of read and think through larger critical problems as they read. And this is something I try to, correct in my own classes, and I encourage all my students to read, and we read a lot. But especially at the high school age, this pre-college age, I was finding as a tutor that, students could read a passage, but then they really couldn't tell you what it was about. And it's not that the students weren't smart. They were really, a lot of them were really bright, but it was just this sort of sense that, and maybe I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist here or an old lady, but the sense that social media and the internet had sort of been ruining them, right? They could look up any answer they had on their phone or on Google, and they didn't have the room anymore to sort of think about things or wonder things through no fault of their own. So I was interested in exploring that issue or problem.
Well, following up, by the way, on the idea about we now live in a world, I mean, when I particularly see films that about periods of the night, for instance, even the 1960s, mm-hmm. in which television was the revolutionary communication, one of the things I kind of wonder about is, are people being overwhelmed by the social media so that they cannot analyze? Is it that we had more time, or are we just being a bit stodgy and saying, oh, well, they don't really understand, when maybe they understand a lot better than we do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. This is a new generation, and they are they're picking up things a lot faster. And perhaps this is my experience being stuck on the older side of it. You know, I'm not keeping
older,
up with
right.
the technology. Well, I'm definitely, I was on the cusp, right? I had the internet in college, but just barely. And and so I do feel a bit overwhelmed. And so maybe some of the story is also about my own sort of fears and phobias of not keeping up and not understanding a younger generation. But I do think there is something about not sort of sitting and wondering and thinking about something. I mean, we do this when we go out to dinner, my husband and I and our friends, we have a question, we're having a conversation, a question comes up and we Google it, you know? And I think that there is something I really miss about tossing a question back and forth and wondering about it and thinking it through instead of just automatically sort of looking up the answer. So...
Well, I'm wondering about that because it sort of follow up here is that because I remember growing up, there was this McLuhan-esque concept of pattern recognition. There was so much information coming to us at that time, which was the 1960s, and in disconnected form, that we had to recognize patterns, that perhaps that what this generation is doing exactly that, but in a different way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the sort of style of Twitter, the very short bursts of story and information is a different sort of pattern. It's very different from the newspaper. That doesn't make it any less. It's a different form. And forms are always evolving and changing. And this is the history of communications. It's the history of literature. So, you know, to say, well, we can't, you know, Kindle is a terrible thing or a smartphone is a terrible thing is not true. It's just a new thing. And I think that... you know, at one point, a book was a new thing. A codex was an innovation. So this is always going to be happening, right? It's just happening at a very fast pace right now.
I must admit, particularly since I've got a smartphone, I find myself actually reading more because I have these apps and I just read when I don't have anything else to do, as opposed to the time you might spend sitting there in an office just sort of staring at everybody else, right?
Absolutely. Or in line for the grocery store.
Right, that's right. So, and it can't get away with it. This seems, by the way, to be the age of the zombie and a zombie apocalypse, right?
Yes.
I mean, with The Walking Dead, and there's a whole slew of other things. You have a story called Another Zombie Story. Tell us a little bit about this. And my understanding is that it's at least is. People have looked at that story, that this is sort of relates to what we're talking about, this sort of deadening through technology.
Sure. Another Zombie Story is a story that's kind of told in two different voices or two different kinds of prose. One is the story of Dee and Jim, who are survivors of the zombie apocalypse, who live in these sort of cloistered communities. I think of them as gated communities in Ohio, or what used to be Ohio, I think this story says. And they're sort of the one thing that connects them, the only thing left on the internet after the zombie apocalypse is dating websites, which is sort of my version of post-apocalyptic America, the worst thing that could happen, I think, to the internet. But and they slowly get together over the course of the story. But the other voice is a voice that's sort of accounting for all the time that's lapsed between the contemporary and the moment, the future moment of the story. So, you know, saying things like, you know, on the internet, you used to be able to find pictures of people with pancakes on their heads, and now there's only internet dating. So it's kind of an accounting of human culture in a certain way, in a very shorthand and sort of terse kind of way, that probably comes across as a little bit satirical or a little bit pointed. And I did kind of mean it that way, but I also think that this idea of zombies, it's really a moment in our culture when we're thinking, we're imagining the worst, right? We're thinking about the end of human civilization as we know it. But I think of the story as hopeful in the end because these two people find each other. And it's this small thing, this coming together. And it really means nothing in the larger scheme of a zombie apocalypse. But I find hope in that.
So when you were, is there a thematic thing then to you in terms of individuals trying to reach across this sort of social, set of social hurdles that we have, whether it's, I mean, because like say 100 or 200 years ago, we lived in very small communities and everybody knew each other. Now we live in communities, not only in cities, obviously, where people don't know each other, New York, Los Angeles, for example, but even in terms of just the person next door, and that there's even more space between us and other people because of social media and the rest of it. And we may even be siloed a bit because the most obvious is, for instance, politics, in which some people, you know, visit certain websites and other websites, and they kind of reinforce it. It sounds like there's this fragmentation that's taking place in society.
Oh, absolutely. I think the idea of a community is the way that I grew up thinking of a community as being made up of neighbors and people who geographically live around you is not something that I experience in my life. I also have moved around a lot, and so that fragmentation, probably I feel it more acutely than, say, my friends who still live in the town where we all grew up. So I do think that there is this sense of fragmentation and isolation, but I mean, that's one of the reasons I write, actually, is to it feels like a reaching out to me, and it feels like a way to connect with other people that is not necessarily through social media or Facebook, which can be very useful tools, but which also feel very curated and very, in some ways, people are always putting their best faces forward. And what I love about writing fiction is that's kind of the opposite. Your characters are putting their worst faces forward, and that's the story. So for me, reading, writing, those are different ways to establish a community. And in fact, there are some wonderful communities popping up on the Eastern Shore and in Baltimore and local places where writers get together and share their experiences of writing and share work with each other. And so I think what's great about, if there is something great about this fragmentation, is that there are, on the internet, there are so many ways to find your new communities. You have to go about doing it, right? You have to make the time to find those writers in Baltimore who are out there and meeting up every Thursday or having an open mic every Friday. But you can do it, as opposed to, you know, just sort of operating by yourself or in your town and not having any idea about what's outside of it. I used to work as a romance editor at Penguin, and one of the cool things about that that culture is that they're very community oriented. So the internet has really helped romance writers start all of these sort of grassroots that turned into national organizations where they get to meet as writers and they and exchange work, and often this is done online. So and then they come together in their regional and their national conferences. And I was really impressed by that, and that these women who were sometimes at home and didn't necessarily have a community of writers where they were, found one online and sometimes several, and then had these events where they could all get together and talk about their craft. And that was really exciting to me.
Now, you also have a story, and I don't have the name in front of it, about a family who's been involved. It sounds like some kind of reality show with the cameras, and this is sort of the last day they're going to spend together as a family. There's a divorce. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about this story, and it seemed almost as if every once in a while there's this public intrusion into this very private moment that's going on in the story.
Absolutely, and I think that was sort of my starting place for that story was. You know, it's a very John and Kate plus eight kind of situation in that there's this family with a lot of kids and they're all in a house together, also living with their camera crew who lives in a spot of their own in the basement. And I was just really curious what, you know, we think of reality TV and we think of shows like that as being kind of ridiculous or a spectacle, and I mean, indeed, that's why they exist. They're sort of a Schadenfreude sense to watching a reality TV show. Well, that's a crazy life. At least it's not my life, right? But I was interested in rehumanizing that, taking a look at what these characters would be like when they weren't under the lights, even though the cameramen are always nearby. The publicity, you know, in the public world and eye and under which they live is always there. And it will never not be in their house as long as they're on TV. But I wanted to construct this very private moment between two people who were people and not characters on TV. So that's what I was really interested in doing there.
Because it reminded me, in fact, of what appears to be one of the first reality television show, which was about the Loud family, in which they had the cameras. In that case, it was all film.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, the way that series actually opened was that it was a New Year's Eve in which the husband and wife were not spending for the first time together. And as you watch the film play out over these, particularly these many years, you get the sense that the intrusion of the cameras and their encounter with this public eye that intrudes in really sort of broke up this family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we kind of see that again and again, right? In the way that the Duggars play out, right. and John and K plus 8 and all of these reality and the people from New Jersey who are going to jail. I can't. But this breaking apart keeps happening, and maybe it would have happened anyway, but there is this sense that something about the cameras, something about that attention and that spotlight weakens something about the family structure. And maybe what it weakens is that intimacy, that ability to have intimate moments that aren't recorded.
So also you have a story when I first read it, I wasn't quite sure what I was looking at, and then I saw a reviewer, and they said, "And this is about field reports, and mm-hmm. this is about a sexual encounter." Explain obviously a bit about the storyline here, but why did you decide this particular form? I mean, because at first blush, you weren't, as a reader, I wasn't quite sure exactly what it was I was looking at.
Yeah, and that's definitely a risk whenever a fiction writer experiments with form, that whenever any writer experiments
sure.
with form, that you're alienating more people than you're inviting in. So that's sort of why I positioned it in the middle of the book, and I didn't want that to be the first thing people encountered. Field Reports is a story about a woman who goes on a series of dates, but it's told from... I don't know what an actual field report looks like, but it's sort of told from this this perspective where the people don't get names, they get letters X and Y, and just very little detail about their situation and scenarios are given, a kind of bare bones snapshot of a series of scenes. And what we come to understand is that the woman has gotten an STD from one of these dates and then has to make the decision about whether or not to report to her next lover. And I think the form came about, the form, for me, form is part and parcel of narrative, of story. So it sort of both of those things gelled at the same time. And going along with the idea of anamnesis or medical history, I felt like to tell this story, I wanted a more detached, a more clinical voice in some sense. And so I decided to just sort of strip the story down to its very bare minimum. And I was really interested in pushing that line and what could I get away with and still make this story make sense. And I'm not sure that I accomplished that. But to me, form is really important. It's as important as the content of a story. And, the writer Andrew Monson says that the history of literature is the history of experimentation. And so for me, I'm always really interested in pushing form and figuring out what I can do, different ways I can tell a story and different ways I can help a reader emotionally connect with characters.
Because one thing, as a matter of fact, I mean, after I read got a sense, then I went back. And one of the interesting things about the form was mm-hmm. that once you got some sense about it, was then suddenly I think one began to be maybe a little more engaged in the sense of like mm-hmm. looking at it. And it reminded me, in fact, it was a poem that was written and read here on campus for an event in which there was only like a single line, right? And mm-hmm. it starts out, and it's a young mother and so on, and as you move through, you suddenly realize that you're hearing about somebody who's getting older to the point where eventually they, I think in this particular case, they get Alzheimer's. And
yeah.
But you get drawn in, and it's only like these single lines, these mm-hmm. just sort of like headline entries.
Yeah, I think I know what story you're talking about,
yeah.
and I love that. And, narrative is an accumulation. It's an accumulation of meaning and emotion and experience on the part of your characters and on the part of the reader too. So I really feel like that is how narrative works for me, whether I'm reading full sentences or whether the form is a little bit more mysterious at first right. blush, perhaps. So I think that there's what I love about fiction is there's all this wiggle room and all this space for doing weird and interesting things that might at first appear to sort of deter a reader. But those are interesting moments to me.
So when you sit down to write, I mean, is it, as a process, is it you catch an idea and you begin to put it to work with it? What's that creative process?
Sure. I often begin with, well, like for the field report story, the idea for a story and then the form sort of hit me both at once. And then the story sort of was, I found myself writing it more in longer sentences, and then I found myself paring it down as I went back to revise. A lot of my stories start with one line or one image, and I go from there, and they don't necessarily spin out from those lines or images, and sometimes those lines or images disappear completely from the story in revision, but there's always some kind of basic visual or situation that I imagine.
So, do you write every day?
I try to. in the summer, yes. During the school year, it becomes a little harder. Yeah. My mentor, Melanie Raytone, gave me this great bit of advice where she said that to touch your work every day. So to think of it when you're really busy as not, you don't have to sit down for 2 hours and churn out work, but just touch it and sort of keep your relationship with the work alive that way.
How much interaction do you think a writer needs with the outside world? I mean, because you have to write about something. You can't just sit there and just come up with it.
Right. I mean, writing is this weird activity where you need to be out in the world, but then you need to be in complete solitude to do your writing. So it's a very strange sort of dichotomy. I think it's very important to be out in the world. Even sci-fi writers, even fantasy writers, the idea is write what you know. I'm sure we've all heard that phrase repeated by countless creative writing instructors, but I take that as write what you understand emotionally, write what your experience is out there in whatever form that may take, whether it's a dragon saga, you know, or a realist novel. So for me, I really found that I spent a lot of my 20s going out and doing a lot of different things, and that sort of feeds my work and definitely fed this collection, my experiences out in the world.
Do these stories reflect people that you know, or combinations of people, or are they separated out from that?
They do. No character is a one-for-one person in the world. I take little bits here and there. I actually called my dad before this collection came out, and I said, look, you're going to recognize some things, but these characters are not you. And he kind of reminded me, he's like, well, I'm used to this. When you wrote for the school newspaper, you announced our divorce in a column, which I had forgotten about, so I apologized.
Obviously, he did not.
No, he did not. I mean, things in this story are taken from real life, but I'm careful to craft my own characters. I don't want to put someone else's experience into my own work.
I was reading, talking about, I guess, one of your favorite writers, you were asked about it, and you talked about Sonny's Blues, which is by James Baldwin. And there's a quote, I ran across from it, which says, "For while the tale of how we suffer and how we are delights and how we may triumph is never new, it always must be heard." Mm-hmm. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, not on the scale of James Baldwin, I wish.
One can aspire.
Right. But absolutely, I think that story ends, that line is such a great artist statement for anyone trying to do art. That's you know, the brother's artist statement for Sonny. That's his idea of why Sonny needs to play jazz. But I think the idea that art comes from pain or suffering, that living is a form of suffering, and especially for African Americans in Harlem and in the last century, you know, was very acute. But we're all in the world, and we're all sort of bearing our own crosses and dragging our own baggage behind us. And art is one way to sort of work through that, I think.
Do you think that this particular kind of writing, too, is it? I don't see as much of it. Maybe I'm not as aware of it, but as much of it as I perhaps would like to think, that is sort of this realistic kind of writing in which things could actually happen the way they are laid out, and that they aren't necessarily great dramatic moments, but rather they're the small moments of people's lives.
Yeah, I think I really admire more plot-driven novels and works. I worked, you know, as a romance and genre editor, and so I love plot. You know, that's excellent. But I also want to look at, you know, plot can take place on a huge scale and it can take place on a tiny scale. And at least for this book, because the plot and the source of story is sort of the body, and specifically my body, that the plot would have to be scaled down, that I would have to look at these small moments, moments that sort of were emotionally resonant for me growing up. And yeah, so absolutely, I think, I think that plot can be large or small, right. but these are kind of, you know, like for the another zombie story, the plot is the thing I leave out, right? I leave out the zombie apocalypse. There are no zombies in the zombie story, but I'm really interested in that moment after. And I think a lot of these stories are about that moment just before or that moment after the big thing, the rupture or the divorce or the miscarriage or something like that.
I mean, yeah, as a matter of fact, talking about the zombies, I'm obviously one of the most popular now is about The Walking Dead, and one of the things about, and people have made the observation, particularly about the television series as opposed to the comic books, is that the series really focuses on the people rather than necessarily on the apocalypse itself.
Absolutely. I think I love that show. It's great. And it's because of the people and their relationships and the politics that they get into, and the sense that they're trying to do this impossible thing. Because after a while, you know, after the first or second season, you were really used to seeing the zombies, and they were sort of an ever-present threat. But it's hard to continue to make them interesting in the sense of the threat is just constant. And so in that sense, I think that the show does this really great job of we kind of get inured to the zombie threat, and we get more interested in how these people are going to organize themselves and sort of be together.
So what's next? I mean, you've got this out. Do you have another collection of stories that you're going to be doing, or what's in the future here?
Well, I'm working on a novel right now.
Oh, okay.
And that's, you know, diligently plugging away on that. That's about a number of different things, but a threesome of friends from high school who come back together under unfortunate circumstances. So,
is it different? How's it different in trying to write a novel as opposed to a just set of short stories?
A friend once explained writing a novel to me as running over a bridge that's falling out from beneath you as you run, and that's exactly what it feels like to me.
Okay, we've been talking with Susan McCarty. She teaches, by the way, creative writing here at Salisbury University, and also the author of a short story anthology called Anatomies, and your debut work, I guess they say. And I appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This is John Lithgow. I love telling a great story, almost as much as listening to one. Get your story fix this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSCL.
The 60s, a period of political and social unrest, a period where accepted norms gave way to entire new ways of thinking. But who cares about that? The important part is the music was cool. Just how cool was it? Well, the best way to find that out is to listen to it. And the best way to do that is to tune in to WSDL Saturday night at 10 and get stuck in the psychedelic era with a hermit for a couple hours. That's right, I said Saturday night at 10, every week on Delmarva Public Radio WSDL.
Since 2010, heroin overdoses have shot up by 95% in Maryland. And many turn to the illicit drug when prescriptions such as OxyContin and Vicodin run out. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. So in February, Governor Larry Hogan unveiled his plan for a strategy to combat the outbreak that included a task force, which will report back to him in December. Hogan noted that heroin use has only been seen as an urban problem, but not anymore. He said that local officials have told him it has become their number one problem. And he adds, this is not just simply a law enforcement problem, but also a health issue. Here on the Lower Eastern Shore, Somerset County Health Department has been awarded a $152,000 grant from the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to implement an addiction prevention program. Mady Barker, who is director of the behavioral health here in the county, and it also says that the drug use is affecting people who don't necessarily, well, fit the traditional profile. And we have her here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk with you about this important problem, this growing public health epidemic.
So describe for me the situation in terms of how serious this has become. And has this like grown rapidly over the last few years, or do you get a sense that this has been stretched out over a long period of time?
This has been developing over the last 5-6 years, actually. But the reason it's gaining so much attention right now is that we are seeing an increase in the number of overdose deaths. And that's what's gaining the national, state, and local attention. We in Somerset County saw a period where we would experience 2 or 3 deaths a year. 2 years ago, we had 7 deaths. Last year, we had 5. We don't know this year what the numbers will be yet, but it's a small county, and it's obviously a great concern to us.
Is that because we're seeing an increasing number of folks who are using heroin and other related drugs, or is that the drug itself is becoming more potent?
It actually is due to a number of factors, and it goes back a number of years where it became very common to prescribe the prescription opiates for pain. And during that time period, larger and larger numbers of people were discovering the effects of it, and we saw an increase in the number of people who were abusing the pills. In the past few years, we've had a number of things happen that has limited their access to the prescription pills. One is that Maryland instituted a prescription drug monitoring plan, which means that doctors and pharmacies can now see if other people have prescribed the opioid medications, and they in turn do not. So it has cut down on the doctor shopping. We've also had a reformulation of the pills where it's very difficult to crush them so that you can inhale them or inject them. And then the other thing that has happened is that the cost of heroin is less than the prescription drug. So people are turning to the cheaper resource.
So what is the solution to this? I mean, you have, you have a program, Unmasked. Tell us a little bit about that first.
Well, our Unmask Addiction program is to call attention to the fact that this is happening throughout our community. I'm not sure what people think the face of addiction is, but it truly is within your family, within your neighborhood, within the workforce. And what we're trying to show is that no one is born addicted, that there's a gradual process where they become addicted, and there are various points you intervene in that. And it may be the student in your classroom, it may be your coworker, it may be your son, your daughter, a spouse. It affects all of us. And we do know that 75% of the people who use heroin started out with a legitimate prescription for an opioid drug, most commonly OxyContin. But so it's not that people start with heroin. It has progressed in their various points that you can intervene to prevent this.
Because, in fact, a few years back, we did a series on heroin addicts, and one of the things they mentioned was the fact that they initially started out using these prescriptions and moved to heroin. One of the things, though, that seems in terms of the jump is it's one thing to get, say, prescriptions from a doctor or a set of doctors, but heroin is illegal. I mean, you have to go to somebody who actually has some kind of criminal connection. How do people make that jump, especially ordinary people who would not enter the criminal system at all? I mean, in terms of criminals themselves.
absolutely. And I can't tell you exactly where you could purchase it. I don't know that myself. But within our treatment program, people report to us that it's very easy to find on the street. And once the word is out that you're looking for it, you'll have no difficulty having someone contact you. Certainly part of this is not just the prevention and the treatment, but the enforcement's very important too. And although our grant focuses primarily on prevention and getting people into treatment, we certainly hope there'll be continued enforcement to limit the supply, because we know when people have access to the drugs, you have greater addiction.
Because one of the things I know that the governor had proposed this task force, and it's reached some mixed reviews, but one, there was a Mike Gimble, I guess, a former drug user who was quoted by one of the local papers. And he was, as a matter of fact, a director, I guess, of Baltimore County's substance abuse program. And he said, we need long-term residential drug-free treatment in the state of Maryland. We've never had it. There are people out there who need it immediately. How do you assess the treatment side of this thing?
We certainly have gaps in our treatment system, and I can speak to what's available with our own county. We have seen a fourfold increase in people seeking treatment for opioid addiction, most of it heroin at this point. We do know that medication-assisted treatment is the scientifically based intervention for people who suffer from opioid addiction. And the most common ones you see here are methadone and Suboxone. We do have a Suboxone program. We see people come in, engage in the program, and are able to regain their life without having the long-term treatment. But that's just one of the interventions available within the county. We also have Vivitrol, which is a newer drug that's a monthly injection that will block the effect of the opiate and reduce the cravings. So although I certainly recognize that long-term residential is one option, there are other treatment options available in the community that will allow people to reclaim their lives, reestablish relationships, gain employment, sometimes for the first time, perhaps to reclaim a profession that they have given up on because of addiction. So we need resources at all levels for treatment, not just the long-term recovery.
So in terms of, particularly in terms of resources, obviously one of the basic resources is family and relatives and friends. How significant is that in terms of getting people to get treatment, but also then allowing them to move on with their lives and put this addiction behind them?
It's absolutely critical, and we have to recognize that most people do not have that support when they enter treatment. They've severed most of those relationships, frequently because they've been stealing from family members. There may be history of incarceration. Sometimes there's violent crime associated with it. So there's a period of time where they have to rebuild that trust with family members. But with all addiction, not just heroin addiction, there has to be support within the community if the person is going to maintain that recovery. So we think it's absolutely critical that the families also engaged in the treatment, understanding what supports are needing, what boundaries need to be set, and things of that nature.
How does a former addict or someone who's trying to get drug-free, how do they repair that relationship?
It's one step at a time, one day at a time. And I know that sounds very
yes,
but it truly is. You can't say to a family member, I'm okay now. I need you to accept me as I am. It's letting them see that you have made changes, that you can be trusted, that you are reclaiming your life. And it's a very long process. It does not happen overnight, but we do see it happen. We see people who are 1-2 years into their recovery and have very strong family supports.
So what do you now? Also, I guess you encourage people to bring in their old prescriptions, that kind of thing. Is that much of the problem, or is that just a small portion?
No, actually, that's a huge part of the problem. We have been able to document nationally that 70% of the abuse occurs from medications that are obtained from families and friends. So an important part of this program is to encourage people to use the drug take-back boxes that are available at all of our law enforcement offices and soon will be available in local pharmacies. We think that will get the drugs out of the home so that people do not have access to them. The other thing that we're trying to do is educate people on how to safely take and store prescription drugs. The prescription is written for you, and it's written at a dose that is safe for you. It does not mean that you should give it to your son, your daughter, your husband, your wife. It's your medication, and it is not meant to be shared. If it's written to take one a day, you take one a day. You don't take three a day because you think you might feel better. And as for the storage, we want people to understand that these are very powerful drugs, and they need to be stored in a locked area, a cabinet, a drawer, a safe, and out of the reach of children and pets. And, of course, you don't want to leave the key around or the combination around. Right. But as I mentioned before, access and availability to these medications is really what is driving this. And if we can limit that in some way, we'll start to get a handle on it.
How much of it is in terms of, say, children who may get access to, say, their parents' drugs, for example? Or might, is that a significant portion of the problem?
It certainly is a portion of the problem. We do know that adolescents are telling us that they are taking prescription drugs that they do not have a prescription for to experience the effect. One of the things with opiates in particular, that certain people seem to have a certain predisposition to the effects of them. And I was recently at a national conference in Atlanta where it was a very large national conference where treatment providers for opiate-dependent people had gathered. And there were stories told by various people that they took one dose and they knew they were hooked for life, that they had never experienced anything like that, and that they knew that was going to be driving them for years to come. Other people will take the prescription and say they can't stand how it feels, can't imagine why anyone would take them. So there's a very individual response to how the opioids affect us. So that's why it's so important that we keep them safely stored so that kids don't have access to them and experience that.
Let me ask you this. How much of it, in terms of addiction, how much of it is in terms of you take it for a while and then you have a withdrawal problem, as opposed to you take it and it makes you feel like a certain way, and no matter what you do, you want to regain that feeling?
Right. We feel that about 10% of the people who use the opiates will end up addicted. But you're right. There is a physical dependence that develops for anyone who uses opiates. And let me be clear, there's a tremendous value to them for people who have acute pain or recovering from surgery. And people will report that they have taken the medication exactly as prescribed for their doctor for pain, and then they say, that's it, I'm not prescribing anymore. And they will experience a mild withdrawal. That's the physical dependence. But the addiction comes with that compulsive behavior. I have to find a way to get more. I can't survive without it. So about 10% of the people who use the opioids will actually become addicted.
Now, I ran across a quote, and someone said that we're doing well when it comes to, say, treating alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, those kinds of addictions. When it comes to the opioids, particularly OxyContin and Vicodin, not so well. Why is there that difference?
I think the difference is in the treatment interventions. And yes, we're doing well with the other substances, but I don't want to minimize the effect that those addictions also have on society. Addiction is the disease. Right now, we seem to be focused on the substance. But what we do know from the opioids is that it has a very significant effect on certain receptors in the brain. And the only way that people seem to regain that function is through some type of medication-assisted treatment that will, in a way, give mild stimulation to those receptors until a period of time when they are restored, or in some cases, people remain on medicated-assisted treatment the rest of their life. That is different from some of the other types of substances that people abuse and eventually become addicted to. There's also still some stigma around medication-assisted treatment, and even within the recovery community, there isn't complete acceptance of the fact that if you are an opioid addict and you are prescribed methadone or buprenorphine and you take it exactly as prescribed, that you are in recovery. There still seems to be some push that you need to get off the medication before you are in recovery. And I think that also interferes with people's willingness to enter into treatment and remain compliant with a treatment protocol.
If one becomes addicted to opioids, does that mean that this is going to be a lifelong issue for you, or is the body capable of putting it behind it? What do you find?
Well, the addiction will be a lifelong issue in the sense that you have to address it throughout your life. In terms of needing to take the medication to address it, we know that some people do recover without the medication. We know some people are able to come off the medication successfully at some point. The problem is we don't know how to identify those people. And we see a tremendous incidence of relapse with people who are on methadone or on buprenorphine for a period of time and say, okay, I'm better, I want to come off of it, and they go back to using the heroin again. So we have a long ways to go in discovering exactly what the science is behind this.
And what kind of impact does this have on a community, I mean, economically and so on?
It has a tremendous impact on it. And in terms of the impact from an overdose death, which is how this actually gained the momentum it has now, for every person who dies from an overdose death, there are 10 admissions to the hospital. There are 32 admissions to the ED or contacts with the emergency department. 130 people enter addictions treatment, and 825 people have the non-medical use of the opioid. So you can see that the overdose deaths are just the tip of the iceberg. All of these others who are involved with abuse of opiates in some way have a tremendous impact on our community. The cost, it's hard to put an exact cost on, although there was a study done by Beacon earlier this year.
For about $49 million,
I think. And those costs reflect the medical costs, which I just mentioned, admissions to hospitals, visits to EDs, treatment costs. It's lost income from employment, not just yourself, but a family member who may need to be absent from work to care for you. It's the cost of incarceration for people that are in our jails and in our prisons. It just goes on and on as to what those actual costs were. It also affects our youth, that if you're living in a home where one or both parents are using substances, again, not just opiates, but that seems to be gaining the most attention right now, there's a cost to the children. There's the trauma to them of watching that. It's missed days at schools, things of that nature. So, it has a tremendous cost to the community.
How do young people react to this, both in terms of addiction, that is, that they may be addicted, and seeing their, maybe their parents or something that that they're very close to become addicted? I mean, what sense do you get about the youth there?
Well, in terms of who is addicted, we're seeing that it is a young population. These are people generally in their mid-20s to early 40s. So that in itself is a little different profile from some of our other people who are in treatment, where it tends to take years for the disease to develop. But in terms of the children of these people, you have to assume that they are experiencing some neglect because of the time the parents spend using as opposed to being with them and enriching their lives and providing that strong supportive environment. In most circles, it's not something that's talked about. So there are lots of secrets within the family that mommy doesn't feel well today when she's actually lying on the couch suffering from the results of her drug use, that daddy got fired from his job, not because of drug use, but because of other factors. So there are lots of secrets within the family, and that creates a very difficult environment for children to do well in school, to feel free to go out and play with friends, because they're always worried about what may be happening at home.
Because I was going to ask you, in terms of children particularly who are growing up, how do they cope with a problem like this when they particularly see a parent? I mean, what is it? Are they resilient? Do they bounce back? What's...
Well, we see a lot of different effects.
Yeah, right.
Some of them end up being the super achiever because they took charge and that they're going to be okay. We see different roles that children assume. Some try to distract from the issue by being the child who acts out, gets in trouble in school so that the focus isn't on mom or dad. We have others that are, kind of the clown of the family, making jokes, making light of it, again, to divert attention from it. And this is true not only in opioid addiction, but in all addiction. So that's why it's so important that we unmask the addiction, bring it out into the open so people can get the help that they need and we don't see these residual effects in families and particularly on our young children.
Now, one of the things I found interesting, because I grew up particularly in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and the thing I remember is the war on drugs. And particularly during the Reagan era and cocaine and so on, the solution was you lock people up, you punish them, and they will not become, they'll come out and presume that they'll be punished enough not to resume their drugs. But prison is a process. I mean, it impacts you. What do you make of the fact that the country seems now to be shifting away from this idea of incarceration? It's not just folks on the left, but conservatives. You see Rand Paul, for example, the senator, talking about this. What do you make of this shift in that conversation?
Well, I think what we've learned is that incarceration doesn't make people better. It may take the problem off the street for the time that they are incarcerated, but when they are released, they come back into the community, and in most cases, they're still suffering from the same disease, which is addiction. And in many instances, they don't have the help available to them at that time, so you may see them returning to previous behaviors. So I think what we're seeing is a shift to looking at our nonviolent criminals and trying to direct them to treatment facilities rather to incarceration, which is, again, a huge cost for the community. While they're incarcerated, they're also not contributing to the society in any way through employment. So I think that's why we're seeing the shift to treatment, because it just didn't work. When people are locked up, they come out pretty much at the point that they were when they were locked up.
By the way, are you concerned? I know that there was just some legislation, looks like it might get passed, to decriminalize marijuana paraphernalia. And obviously there was decriminalization of marijuana itself, so that it becomes more of a civil issue. Are you concerned at all that this will encourage people to utilize the drug, and i.e. do you view this particular drug or all those drugs as gateway drugs? What's your feeling about that? Because you've been spending a lot of time looking at this.
We have been, and quite honestly, we assume that marijuana will become legal at some point. This year, next year, we don't really know. Alcohol has been legal for many, many years, so we're looking at marijuana more from the same viewpoint we do from alcohol, that it is dangerous for some. It can be a gateway drug, but we want to identify who those high-risk individuals are that should be educated and hopefully abstain from using the marijuana if and when it becomes legal. Our youth are the number one group that we are concerned about. Not only can it be considered a gateway drug, but we know that it affects the cognitive function of the developing adolescent brain. And that's really significant because, You know, as we all know, adolescents have enough challenges in their life without having that brain affected. And some of these changes in cognition that have to do with memory and judgment and problem solving are very long term. We don't know if it's permanent, but there's a chance that they could be. So we don't want our youth to be disadvantaged because they thought that pot was safe for them.
Do you think there'd be enough controls? I mean, obviously now it's a decriminalized issue. I mean, for instance, it became even legalized. Do you think there's enough controls that would keep it there? Because, I mean, I can remember growing up, alcohol obviously was the drug of choice, I guess, for a lot of folks, even in high school. And it was very easy to get. Kind of blurs the lines there, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And we still struggle with alcohol. I mean, access to alcohol with our youth is still a huge problem and one we focus on every day. We've got a lot of work to do yet with limiting the access to marijuana, alcohol, and then the whole issue of opioids.
So are you optimistic that you'll be able to cut down this the overdose death and the use of opioids and so on?
Well, we hope that the decline of overdose deaths from 2013 to 14 was not an anomaly, that mm-hmm. we actually have started to make some progress. The other thing that we know saves lives is Narcan. And this is something that we want to get widely distributed throughout the community so that people who are in a position to reverse the effects of overdose can do that. We will be offering training programs to those people April 22nd, May 20th, June 17th. We will provide not only the certificate that says they are authorized to administer it, but we will give them a voucher to go get the medication for free. We have already trained large numbers of law enforcement in our community so that the more people that are in a position to reverse the effect, the fewer deaths we will have.
Well, we've been speaking with Mady Barker. She's the director of behavioral health in Somerset County. And we've been talking about the new program to prevent drug addiction. We appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.